Thank you all, and hello, Fred. So I got here a little early this morning, and I tried to do a little focus group with some of the attendees about why are you here. And the first group I asked said, well, what we really like about this conference is you have a lot of discussions with a lot of panels, and it's not just one guy standing up there talking. So I thought maybe I should stop asking that question. I want to tell you three quick vignettes that I experienced that led me to taking on the moonshot job a year ago, a week from today. It feels like a lot longer. We left what seems like a year ago, but it was really only not even 2 months. The first was in 2003, I started an organization for Mike Milken called Faster Cures, which was just what it sounds like. Many of you probably go to their partnering conference they have every year in New York. David Baltimore was on our board. And I called him up one day, and I said, here's what we've got planned. And I go through agenda item one. Oh, I don't care about that. And if you know David, he can be a pretty cranky guy. So I went to item number two. I don't care about that. Item number three. I don't care about that. So finally I said, David, why are you on my board if you don't care about these specific things we're doing? And he said, I'll tell you why I'm on your board. This is 2003. It's time we start taking chances in cancer. We have been studying it forever. And we know enough now to start taking chances in people. We will never understand it all. We know so much. And this is David Baltimore, the poster child for basic research, saying that it's time we start taking chances. That was 13 years ago. And I think certainly with IO therapies, we are. And we're taking reasonable chances, consented chances, but it's taken us a while to change our mindset. The second vignette was when Leon Black, who runs the Apollo Group, his wife had melanoma, and it was misdiagnosed for a long time and went to stage two before they found it, which is not good. She's doing fine, but he said, we need to start a melanoma research nonprofit. So in 2007, I believe it was, we started something called the Melanoma Research Alliance. And I was asked, as the head of Faster Cures, Leon was on my board, to put the meeting together. So I read nothing but melanoma papers for about 3 months. It got so bad I couldn't even shave because I had med school hypochondria, that every mark on my body was melanoma. But we pulled a group of high-powered young and old people into a very small room, 30 people really elbow to elbow. And when I talked to all my doctor friends who treat cancer, they all had told me the same thing about what the situation was in melanoma. So when we started that meeting, I said, you know, let's all agree on one thing. Nothing works. Let's just start there. And you had in the room Don Morton from John Wayne. You had Steve Rosenberg from NIH. You had Neil Rosen, who's speaking here later today. You had Levi Garraway, Jed Wolchick, a lot of young people who became bigger names than they were that day because of their work in melanoma. But we started with the assumption that nothing works, and now what are we going to do about it? And we decided the only way to change things was to change things. So we created a foundation that funded people in a very different way. Third of the money only to young people. Third of the money only to inter-institutional collaborations. And a third of the money to the old guard, because you have to give the old guard some money. They've earned it. And now they're one of the leading, if not the leading, private funder of melanoma research and have been involved in all of the successful drugs that have hit the market in melanoma. The third story is a little different. The middle of 2014, a friend of mine told me, a young mother, two children, that she had been diagnosed with GBM. And she didn't know much about it. I unfortunately knew a lot about it. And I pretty much knew what her next 18 months would look like and did what I could to help her get clinical trials. She had 3 surgeries. And about a month later, I'm getting off an airplane in San Francisco. I had a physical on earlier in the week, and 3 or 4 days had gone by, and I hadn't heard anything. And I'd had, you know, some PSA issues in the past, so I thought I should call before he closes for the weekend. So I'm getting my, you know, you're getting your bag off, you're waiting to get off the plane. I called my doctor and I said, how'd my physical come out? He said, well, now keep in mind, I called him, okay? Your PSA is good, your cholesterol is good, but by the way, you have leukemia. And I said to myself and then to him, by the way, I have leukemia? Isn't that the way? It's not by the way. And he said, well, you have 160,000 white cells and you're supposed to have fewer than 10,000. So you need to get this checked. No shit. So I happened to be visiting a doctor. I went and got it checked. I actually had 180,000 white cells. And everybody was worried about what kind of cells they were, blah, blah, blah. It turned out they were the nice, small, slippery kind, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I didn't need treatment for a year. Never was sick, never got sick. All through my chemo, which I started and finished a year ago, January, never got sick, never got tired, never missed any work, did board calls while I was being infused. You looked at that chart he had just a minute ago on CLL deaths, you saw that the new cases were here and the deaths were here. 10 years ago, they're all there, right? So, yes, there's cancer progress. So I tell you those three stories for a reason. One, we need to be taking a lot of chances in cancer because we know a hell of a lot. We're not there yet, and there are reasons I'm going to talk about today about why we're not there yet. Secondly, you can change things. Melanoma is certainly an example. Lung cancer is another example. There'll be many more. And third, this is highly personal for pretty much everybody. I really don't meet anybody who hasn't been affected by cancer. And neither does Vice President Biden. Now that he's private citizen Biden, he goes to a diner near his home in Virginia that he's when he's in D.C. And literally, the first time he went to the diner, over the course of a hamburger, everybody in the diner came over and thanked him for his work on cancer and told him why it had affected their family and how it had affected their family. So that's my preface to the moonshot. And I know that you all have heard about the moonshot. You're in the business, you're in the industry. But let me tell you a few things that you should know about the moonshot. I'm not going to read you what you could read if you went on and looked it up. But I also wanted to talk about the moonshot, what it did, where it is now, where we're doing with the Biden Cancer Initiative, and then talk a few minutes about the things that affect all of your businesses if you're trying to develop new therapies in cancer, and why we need to really change our way of thinking in order for you to be successful at what you're doing. So imagine you're me and you get a call from Vice President Biden's office. They said, can you come tomorrow? I'm in New York and dinner. And they said, can you come tomorrow morning and meet Vice President Biden? And I said, I'm in New York. I'm supposed to have a meeting with my leukemia doctor tomorrow for a checkup. And they said, well, we can do this a week from now. I said, okay. And I hung up the phone, and I thought, what am I, stupid? And so I called my doctor. Now it's like 9:30 at night. I called my doctor from Sloan Kettering, and I said, Vice President Biden wants to talk to me about this cancer moonshot thing, but I'm supposed to see you tomorrow morning. And he said, what, are you stupid? Go see Biden. You can talk to me any day. So I did, and here I'm faced with, how do we double the rate of progress in cancer? How do we get a decade's worth of progress in prevention, detection, diagnosis, care, and survivorship in 5 years? So how would you think to yourself, how would you do that? What does that mean? How do you go about doing that? And I'm dealing with about 20 government agencies and offices sitting around the table who aren't used to questions like that. They have a lot of PowerPoints about incremental changes, a few more people in clinical trials, a little more money in this program. That wasn't going to do it. So I asked the Moonshot Task Force to do two big things. Number one, figure out where you touch the patient in the patient's journey from preventing cancer, detecting it, diagnosing it, treating it, and surviving it. Figure out where you as the VA or the Department of Energy or the NCI or Commerce Department, where do you touch people in their journey in cancer? And how do you double your impact at that point in half the time? And the second question was, look around the room at all these agencies and find someone you've never worked with before and collaborate with them to do something new and wonderful. Those were the two questions we asked. That's not the questions they were used to getting. So, to my great pride and to, in some cases, astonishment, that's exactly what they did. The National Endowment for the Arts started working with the Cancer Institute on programs that talked about surviving cancer. NASA started working with the NCI around using its radiation laboratory to test new carbon ion beam radiation therapies. The Department of Energy convinced the Veterans Administration to give them $4 million, which is a rare thing, so that all of the medical records at the VA, the world's largest hospital, could be analyzed by the DOE supercomputers to find patterns and predictions. And those computers, and I know this is a silly number, do a million billion computations a second. All right? A million billion computations a second. When you're modeling nuclear weapons, you get really good at computing because the alternative is pretty unthinkable. So you have to figure it out through computing, and that's what we're able to do now. So all of a sudden, people were doing new things in new ways. And two or three of the things that I could tell you about were in conjunction with the private sector, because a large part of this was not just about what can the government do, but how do we get the whole world, but certainly the companies in America and foundations and universities and individuals and companies in every sector, to change the way they approach cancer, to double their progress in half the time. So as an example, we were able, through a series of fortuitous drop-ins at my office, find out that Walter Reed has the best sequencing facility I'd heard of outside of the Broad. Nobody knew about it. They've got like a dozen X10 Lumina machines, and they can do an amazing number of sequences a day. Well, the VA has a lot of people with cancer, and they needed to be sequenced, and they were having trouble getting that all up and running and affording it. So Walter Reed said, we'll analyze all your cancer tumors for free. Just leave some on the way out the door. And then IBM shows up, a friend I'd worked with 20 years ago when I was in information technology, and said, how can we help? And I said, well, what do you got? And they, of course, have IBM Watson. So they agreed that they would analyze the tumor sequencing data from Walter Reed to provide tumor boards with all known therapies for those mutations, and they can do it within hours, not days and weeks. And they would do it for free for 2 years as proof of concept. So now, all of a sudden, the VA went from what are we going to do with these cancer patients to getting people sequenced and analyzed and hopefully treated in record time. This happened over and over again. We went to the Genomic Data Commons in Chicago, where all the Cancer Genome Atlas genomic data is stored. When we were there, there were 14,000 people's genomic data. Over a month later, as a result of many collaborations, there were over 30,000 people. That database was accessed 5 million times in the next 6 months. And we continue to add things to it. We started something called the Proteogenomics Project. It goes by the acronym of APOLLO, which is just what it sounds, a protein and gene database that's being put together by DOD, DOE, VA, the National Cancer Institute, a number of companies, the Department of Defense, to aggregate raw genomic and proteogenomic data for all the reasons that you all know. And then there's something called the Blood Profiling Atlas, which has now decided to organize itself into an independent nonprofit consortium. It started as several companies and the VA and the FDA and the NCI around how do we get an atlas that tells us what's real in blood profiling in liquid biopsies, because it's a complicated area. So that started off small, now has over 20 members, and now is actually standing itself up as an organization with an executive director, all around the notion that if we're going to use liquid biopsies and blood profiling, we have a long way to go to tell junk from value, and we needed to start doing it collaboratively. And the FDA was probably the most excited participant in the meeting. I could go on because there are over 70 or so of these private type collaborations. But let me put it this way. When we had a summit in June of 2016, we had 400 people at a room in Howard University. Vice President was there. A lot of people were there. But it was mainly a workshop. And the news wasn't that. The news was that there were 7,000 people gathering at 270 summits in every state in the country and Puerto Rico and Guam on the same day to do the same thing as support of the moonshot. So over the course of last year, there were a lot of programs that were developed. There were a lot of volunteerism going on. But the real news was it went from a program to a movement that people are still joining. And they don't care whether we're in the White House or not. I get emails every day from people I don't know and companies I've never worked with asking how can we be involved in the Moonshot and the Cancer Initiative. Which brings me to what's happened since then. And, oh, by the way, we also got $1.8 billion from the Republican Congress before they left last year for the Moonshot. Over 7 years. We had asked for $1 billion and we got 1.8 over 7 years. So that money will be spent according to the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon panel that was part of the Moonshot that reported out last August, unless the new administration decides not to do that. But there was such bipartisan support for the Moonshot that I'm not too worried about that. One other by the way story. You know, when you're dealing with the VA and the Walter Reed, you have a lot of military people in the room, and they're used to speaking when spoken to. So sometimes, you know, you kind of wish they wouldn't do that. So one particular colonel was sitting on the wall behind the meeting where his boss and some other people were sitting, and we were talking about the VA and cancer and blood profiling. And he used my favorite phrase, "Oh, by the way, we take blood samples every 2 years from active duty soldiers to check for HIV. We've been doing that for over 25 years. We have hundreds of thousands of serum samples. We could check those for people who have cancer now and start seeing what we can find." And the whole room's head snapped around like, yeah, why haven't we done that already? And then when they heard that, the Department of Defense in general said, oh, yeah, we've got several million tissue slides that we've never digitized. Maybe we should do that. So all of a sudden, just because of by the way comments, we had launched two huge programs to track the people that we've been tracking for other reasons, but to now track them to see if there's a precursor of the cancer that they may have now. And at the end of the year, in conjunction with John Stewart and Stephanie McMahon from World Wrestling Entertainment, we had a meeting with active duty soldiers who contracted cancer during their service and first responders who had contracted cancer from 9/11 in particular to talk about the particular challenges they face, the environmental exposures that may have caused those cancers, and what we can do about it. So the Moonshot, you probably know a lot about, but there was a lot you didn't know because it wasn't all news every day. But now, out of the government, Vice President Biden has started the Biden Foundation, which currently includes the program of the Biden Cancer Initiative, which I run now, which we will spin out soon into its own independent nonprofit so that we can pursue the very issues that we were dealing with in the Moonshot, which is what I want to talk about now, because those are the issues you deal with every day, either consciously or perhaps more importantly, subconsciously. And that is, what are we doing to learn from what everybody does in the sense of sharing data? What are we doing in clinical trials and how are they changing to adapt to the change in therapy and knowledge in the precision medicine world? How do we guarantee that people in every corner of the country have access to the same kind of care you get in the big cities and near the big cancer centers? And how do we change our culture in general to add a sense of urgency and to change the way we're doing science research, which is still following the same processes it did following World War II. You know, as human beings, if you look at what a human being does in the course of a day, the what hasn't changed that much. What has completely changed is the how. So you've always had friends and you always kept up with them one way or another, but now you can keep up with them with your thumbs instead of having to drive over to their house because you couldn't reach them on the phone. You know, we still go out to eat, but now it's completely different. You can find everything online. It can be there when you get there. It wasn't like you just show up in the old days and hope there's a seat. Travel, credit, mortgages, investing, everything is done differently than it was ever done before. The one thing that's not done differently is what you do. What you do is still based on the system we had when everything was on paper. And the only way you could share information was to mail it or to go to an annual conference and talk about it. So what do we do in cancer? Everybody gears up for the AACR in a few weeks. Everybody gears up for ASCO. Everybody gears up for the immune therapy conference. Well, we're still following the model people followed when they had no other choice. You have a lot more choices now. So just take the issue of data sharing. So when you have a field like immunotherapy and you saw all the charts that Jeffrey had up there, one of the problems is that we don't know what we know. Things go on every day in doctors' offices all over this country that other doctors will never know about. Companies will never find out about. It may be off-label, so you can't put a claim in unless you want to spend weeks arguing about it. Why does that matter? Well, you know, ask Fred Frank here if he would like to invest in a world in which the only way you know what happened in the market is if you called 10 close people and said, what happened in the market? There's nowhere to go to find out what happened in the market. Would that be a good system? But that's exactly what we have in healthcare. I refer to the health data system, and do I even need to talk to you about electronic medical records? If you all are patients or have gone to a doctor, do I even need to tell you how silly it is that every other aspect of your life can be found this far away from you on your phone? But to get your medical record more often than not, you've got to go somewhere or it's got to be faxed to you. I'm not even going to talk about it. It's so disgusting. We can fix it, but we're not there yet. But I do want to talk about data sharing and why it's important. The two ways of looking at health data are this. Number one, it's all insider trading. I know stuff, you know stuff. Let's share with each other, but let's not tell the world yet. We've got 9 more months to ASCO. Let's see what we can get done before everybody else knows that this worked. You know, the other way of thinking of it is the great video about men's brains versus women's brains. Health data is definitely a men's brain situation, which I mean is it's made up of little boxes that are not connected, that are only focused on whatever it is they were focused on. So guys go into their nothing box, they're watching football, and you cannot just walk up and interrupt them. You have to say, hello, I'm getting ready to interrupt you, I need to talk to you, because they've got to switch boxes. They've got to get into their, oh, I'm married box. I have to have a conversation box. We don't live there. We live in the nothing box. That's where health data is. It lives in little boxes, whereas a woman's brain is completely interconnected, physiologically and psychologically. And if you're married, you know that there's nothing you can do in a marriage if you're a man that is not instantly related to everything you have ever done. Right? There's no such thing as a discrete event to women's brains. Everything is connected historically, and then they project into the future, and then you have to say, I'm sorry, as fast as you can. You know, the first phrase I always hear is, you always do that. And I'm like, how can you remember? Anyway, you get the point. Well, why does that matter? Well, think about it. We have thousands of patients in clinical trials. And we still don't know what goes on in a great number of them, even though it's been a requirement for years. Doctors generally prescribe the same medicines through most of their career that they prescribed when they got out of med school. New therapies take years to get into practice, and people don't feel the urge to report data. So think about this. You go to the doctor, you fill out the ubiquitous clipboard. What are the last two pages always are? Do I have permission to check your insurance and do all that? Do I have permission to check your credit? Why isn't the doctor signing the last piece of paper that says, I, the patient, direct you, the doctor, to share my data as the default to acknowledged and certified research institutions, either of my choosing or of yours, but it's not a choice, it's an obligation. That's not the reality by a long shot, and you all know it. So it matters because everything else in your life now is interconnected. We lose people because we don't share data. And to me, the biggest tragedy of the moonshot is we shouldn't be losing people to the cancers we can cure because we're still losing so many people to the cancers we can't. And yet data sharing and data standards, I sent a pathology report from Mayo to a doctor in California who called me up and said, this is exactly what's wrong with our medical system. This was done at Mayo. And I can't tell, there were two different cancers involved. I can't tell what kind of cancers they are from this slide and this report. I can't tell how they got it. I can't tell how big the margin was. I can't tell how they fixed it or preserved it. If I were asked to treat this person, I'd have to do it again. That's unacceptable. Why? You get $600 for a path report, whether you take a little or a long time. So people are, it's not because they're venal. It's because they're overworked and because we don't have standards for how we describe cancer, even today. So, you know, it's a historical problem. We categorize cancers by the French system from the 1700s. We publish under the German system from the 1800s. We give people tenure based on the wrong things and wonder why they're not doing the right things, by which I mean working on cures and developments. But let me talk for just a moment, because I think you probably experience the data issue more than most, about clinical trials. We had a meeting the other day of people who want to advise us about the issues that should be of importance to us in the Biden Cancer Initiative. And we had some very prominent cancer doctors, scientists, patient groups, and CEO of a company, major pharma company. We had a knockdown, drag-out fight over this question. Do cancer trials ever put people on placebos? Because a lot of people don't want to go into cancer trials because they're afraid they'll get the placebo. And most of us have spent a lot of time explaining to people, you generally don't do placebos in cancer trials because you're doing the new therapy against the standard therapy. And if there's no therapy, it's usually more of a compassionate use case where you're just getting the therapy. No, that's not true. One of the doctors who treats hundreds of cancer patients a week said in phase 3 trials for people who have failed everything else, people use placebos all the time because there is no standard and because you have to have some comparator to the new therapy. So if a group of experts could argue about it, imagine the lay people who are asked to be in a clinical trial. But there's another shift happening, which is all of my life, clinical trials were not about you. They were about the future and science, and you couldn't even tell a patient a trial would benefit them. It was unethical. And yet now, what you hear all the time is people thinking of clinical trials as treatment, because it often is in the real world. People say your only hope to survive this is going to be a trial. Well, that is a bigger change than most people give credit for. And the other problem is this. There are a lot of really bad trials. There are a lot of redundant trials that people could avoid if they'd reported the first trial. There are a lot of trials people shouldn't be in, and the ones they should be in get oversubscribed very quickly. And now, with the anti-PD-1 trials, we're going to have literally thousands of trials to compare drugs in combination, because the companies are just going to figure out what drug can I pair with my drug. And that has several ramifications. Number one, it's like children's soccer. Everybody's chasing the ball and there's no one to pass it to. So we've got way too many people working on the same thing, but there's no way to get them to stop because they feel like they have to tell their shareholders, here's our anti-PD-1 drug. The other problem is we're using all these patients in the control arms, and the patients are the scarce resource. The scientists are the surplus resource. What we really should be doing is asking cancer patients, what kind of trials do you want? What kind of standard of living do you want as the endpoint? What kind of pain are you willing to put up with? Let's design those trials and then put them out to bid to companies and scientists, because right now the surplus resource, the scientists, design trials that are not attractive to the scarce resource, the patients. Or they put redundant trials together and ask patients to join all these control arms, when in addition to using centralized IRBs, we could be using centralized control arm data. Because if you're doing a trial against the standard of care and we know patient response to the standard of care, why are we putting thousands of people into control arms to do the exact same thing that's already been done? And yet, we still do it. So clinical trials, which are the sine qua non of progress in this industry, are not understood, are misdesigned, misdirected, and we all know how hard it is to recruit for them. That is one of the problems that have to be fixed. But then there's another problem that came up also this morning in Jeff's slides, and that was the issue of price. Now, in the Cancer Moonshot, we dealt with a lot of issues. We had one meeting on price at the summit with a lot of people. And we and Vice President Biden were not in the let's yell at the pharma side of the issue, because we know that you have the price of the drug from the company, and then you have the pharmacy benefit manager who gets a rebate that never passes to the patient, and payers who set copays based on formularies that sometimes make patients pay more for the better drug and less for the not so better drug because it's less expensive. And I don't think we can blame the pharma company for that. I don't think we can blame the pharma company for the rebate being high and never going to the patient. I don't think we can blame the patient for balking at a copay that puts them either into bankruptcy or maybe something that will help them. So we have to have a new system. And cancer is a unique case. Cancer, more than any other disease, is all about failure. Patients bear the burden of iterative trials and iterative drugs that fail. This doesn't happen as much, if at all, in diabetes or cardiology. We know what the treatment is, and most people either respond if they can respond. But in cancer, the odds of the first therapy working for you if you have a hard-to-treat cancer is very slim. So people not only have to spend a lot on each successive drug, but if you now have combination drugs, how are we going to do that? How are we going to do that? So you hear a lot about value, about how much does it, you know, how much life does it give you to make it worth $100,000 a year? We hear a lot about outcomes-based pricing. And that all has to change. But one thing that really has to change is the, once again, we're still using a system that hasn't changed since the 50s. Every other industry has figured out how to use finance to avoid risk. So if you were reading the paper in the oil crisis in the 70s, the headline was, oh my God, price is going up. Today the headline is, oh my God, price is going down. Why is that? Have you ever asked yourself, why is that? Well, it's because oil went from being a cost to an asset. In the 70s, there were no oil products, financial products, that you could own. You couldn't own a contract for the delivery of oil in the market in the 70s. But we created all these financial instruments to encourage drilling, to encourage ownership, so people would speculate in oil, price support that way, and now oil is an asset that you all own, whether you know it or not. And so when the price goes down, you all lose money. And you lose more than you save at the pump. So we fixed oil by making it an asset so people care about it and they own it. But not in health. Health has been a cost your whole life, and you still think of it that way. I asked a group of bankers from UBS a few years ago, I'm going to say a word, and you tell me what you think, and they all had iPads that threw it on the screen. I said, health, and they all said, cost. And I'm like, have you heard of the Fidelity Biotech Index? Have you heard that biotech and health were the best performing sectors over the last 10 years? And the answer was no, we hadn't, because they don't think of it that way. They think of it as a cost. Well, if it's a cost, everybody wants to keep it down. But if it's an asset, everybody wants it to grow. I think the more we spend on good health, the better. It's not a bad thing. The problem is you can't own it. Try owning a portfolio of Alzheimer's companies through a traditional mutual fund or exchange-traded fund. You can't find it. My old company, Polywog, was working on designing that. Why does it matter? Farmers know more about hedging their liability than the CEO of pharma companies do because they can go to the futures market. They don't sell their wheat when they harvest it. They sell it the year before. JetBlue doesn't buy fuel at the pump. They buy it a year before. But big pharma and insurance companies are a cash flow business in the largest sector of the economy. Does that make any sense? An insurance company cannot predict their cancer liability next year with any certainty at all. So they get all kinds of problems from that. They delay new products getting to patients. They have to raise rates a lot. And yet there are simple things like futures markets to allow you to say, you know what? I can afford a 5% increase next year in my diabetes budget, but not 10. So I'm going to go out and make a bet with somebody based on some index that if it goes up more than 5%, they'll pay me. And if it goes up less than 5%, I'll pay them. This happens every day in thousands of markets, in credit, in agriculture, in energy, in you name it, in the weather. There are futures markets for the weather, but not for cancer, not for Alzheimer's, not for diabetes. And the result is pharma has no idea how they're going to get the benefit of future savings from their drugs that cure people. And insurance companies have no way to hedge their liability for next year. So every time there's a new drug that's great and costs a lot of money, instead of saying thank you, we say, how could you do that to me? How could you ask me to spend that much money to cure somebody? Well, that's a bad question. That's a really bad question. So once again, the fault is not in the stars, as they say, but in ourselves. We're operating with a system that still treats medicine as Jonas Salk in a white coat solving things, that rewards people for publishing things without changing anybody's lives, and that makes companies deal with financial liability as if there's no such thing as a futures market or being able to hedge or being able to get the value of saving a life net present value today. All of these things can be fixed. So at the end of the day, what the moonshot showed us was that there is an enormous passion around the country for people to change the way they're doing things to improve the way we deal with cancer. And yet that's often not what people think about that are in the field themselves. The people inside the NIH system aren't trying to change it that much. But when new things come along, Sean Parker, Mike Milken, they set up things that look completely different from NIH. They set up things that give you feedback very quickly, money very quickly. You have to share your data. You have to collaborate with other people in the network. And yet, in the government, we let people be designated cancer centers without any sharing requirements whatsoever. This cannot be a formula for success. And the other thing we learned is that everybody wants to play in this one. In the original moonshot, most of us couldn't do much to help. In this one, everybody can do a lot to help. Patients can demand their data be shared. Doctors can share data and meet with people and find out what happened in this experimental therapy or compassionate use. Companies can collaborate with NCI and NIH on pre-competitive research. Companies, as they are doing at the National Cancer Institute, can pre-license their drugs for combination trials and save literally years in setting up combination trials. We can create new financial instruments to deal with the pricing issue. We can create new databases to help analyze all this and to translate this Tower of Babel of electronic medical records into a common language today and then standards that people have to use tomorrow. We can do all of that. So then here's the final question I have for you, and then I'll take your questions. It's the question that I got when I started this. New York Times calls, and they say, why would you take this job? What can you get done in 9 months? And the first thing I said was, stop talking to my wife. The second thing was, well, you know, Murphy's Law goes both ways. Sometimes the work compresses to fill the time available. And 9 months is a long time. It's a long time. It's time enough to have a baby that might change the world. It's time enough to get a lot of things started that could change the world. It's obviously now, looking backwards, been time enough to energize the entire country and people around the world in a nonpartisan, non-self-interested way to contribute to what it means to help patients on that journey from prevention to survivorship. And most importantly, 9 months was half of the life my friend had with brain cancer, and it was enough time to at least start doing things to give the next person whose half life was 9 months hope that we can change things. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will make any of this successful, any of these changes work, is if people like you, who are in the trenches every day, who've been doing this for years, who have more professional degrees than I can imagine, if you don't believe we can change the system, if you don't believe we can do things better and faster as every other industry has, then we really are in trouble. So the first thing that has to happen to make progress in cancer is that we all who are doing it every day have to believe it's possible if we change the way we're doing things to have a sense of urgency and to double the rate at which we think we can make an impact so that we can double the rate we make an impact. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions.
Brother Simon, inspirational, a stellar talk.
Thank you.
What can we do to make sure the Trump administration, you know, continues to support the cancer moonshot?
Great. So, you know, I read a paper a year ago in Nature. I'll have to send the citation to the organizers. Comparing the war on cancer to the war on terror. And it said, you know, when you have a drone strike, the survivors become more radical, not less. And when you attack a lot of cancers, most cancers, they become more radical, not less, because you never kill them all. And in fact, what they found was the substance called alarmin that activates cellular regression to a primitive evolutionary state that makes them more aggressive occurs in all the cells when you attack the cancer cells. Not just the cancer cells, but the healthy cells too. So all of this is a way of saying there are some instances where the more you attack something, the more virulent it becomes, making a very subtle political point. Think about it. So the short answer is benign neglect. There's nobody in the White House doing what we were doing. That's okay. I tell people we had a one-year charter. That actually wasn't a bad thing. If Hillary had won, she said she would continue it, but who knew how? So the fact there's nobody in the White House doesn't matter. What matters is what's at your house. Are people still thinking about this, working on this, volunteering for this? And the answer is yes. Meanwhile, all of the agency programs we started are still going on because they're run by career people, they're paid for, and they're mission related. I hope nobody goes to the VA and says, stop working on this cancer problem. I can't imagine that. The money was spent the first year, according to the Blue Ribbon panel. There's no reason not to keep doing that. This was a nonpartisan, very broad-based group. So I am optimistic that this will continue going forward. Certainly, NCI is a safe place to argue about doing it, but also, surprisingly, the Patent Office. The Patent Office had some of the best ideas we had in the task force. And last time I gave a talk, I met somebody who had their patent accelerated under their program to accelerate oncology-related patents for no fee. And that's working. And so, believe it or not, and we all know how important the Patent Office is here. So that's one. The other is NASA. There are going to be a lot of cuts to NASA, unfortunately, but we can't cut things like radiation research because it's so central to what we do in cancer. Next question. Yes, Fred.
Uh, if you go back further in the system to the medical schools, seems to me that's a good place for which change should start. And maybe you could address that question, because I think it's a pretty serious question.
Yes, that's a great question about how does med school change affect all this. Well, think about the fact that in every other industry, the leading graduate programs are cutting edge. If you get an MBA at Wharton, you're studying financial thinking and models that haven't hit the market yet. If you go to med school, you're always a generation behind. Genetics, 10, 15 years ago, people in med school weren't getting genetics and genomics. They're still not getting nutrition. They're still not getting microbiome, which is the next topic. They're not getting the future. They're getting the past. Now, obviously, you want a surgeon to know how to do that, and that's been a century of experience. But it's just unfathomable that we put doctors out there, especially in cancer, who are basically going to be researchers, whether they want to be or not. Because eventually, if you're treating cancer, you're using an off-label drug for a particular patient, and you have to do research. You have to understand what's going on. That's not being taught. So there's a lot of post-med school education that in hospitals and in practices. But med school model, which has basically been torture people for many years, and if they survive, they can be doctors, and then they learn medicine. That's a bad idea. So whatever you all are doing in immunotherapy, you can bet that 10 years ago, med school wasn't teaching that. Whereas if you're in computing and you hire some 25-year-old, they teach you what's going on. You don't teach them. So we have to change that as well. It's the whole system. It's a great question. Another question? Did I offend anybody that wants to? I hope at least. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, but we still have time. Is there a market for these financial instruments that you talk about?
Yes. The company I started that I left, and which I have no financial interest in now, because I had to give it all. Unlike Trump, I had to give up all my stocks. Can I tell you one funny story about stocks and conflicts of interest? I was all invested in health, because I, for the very reason that I believe health is an asset. So I had to get rid of all my health stocks. Okay, I got that. I'm running the cancer moonshot. But we had no money to grant. We had no particular, you know, authority to regulate anything. So they wouldn't let me buy airline stocks. And I said, really? I can't buy airline stocks? I mean, I understand I can't buy Google because they're in health and Amazon's in health and Microsoft's in health. But airline stocks? And they said, well, you're part of the Health and Human Services, which I was. And then I was loaned to the White House. And the Center for Disease Control is part of Health and Human Services. And they determine quarantines. And if there's a quarantine, it affects airline stocks. So you can't own airline stocks. That's what Democrats put up with. What are we thinking? I should have said, sue me. You know, just sue me. I'm going to buy a Delta or whatever. That's not how it works. So is there a market? So the company that I helped start has been building an index around diseases, specifically diabetes. You know this company, they started an ETF called SBIO, S-B-I-O, which was the top performing health exchange traded fund in 2014. Or no, 2015, it was up 40%. It was its first year on the market. It's all small companies. But they've been taking this index that shows the price of treating a patient to banks, to insurance companies, to reinsurance companies, and the excitement is enormous. They're publishing that index this month. The first trade of that index for a futures purpose will be this month. So that once these things start, they take on a life of their own. The insurance companies have been looking for a way to hedge liability forever and a day. This is the best way to do it. Certainly better than price controls. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the talk. I met recently with Senator Murphy from Connecticut about the cancer moonshot. And if my understanding is correct, in 5 years you want to make the innovation that's going to take what we expect now to be 10. And the NIH, 92% of the people who apply for an NIH grant don't get funded. There's no difference in the quality between that 75th percentile and the 8th percentile. Right. And the 8% that get funded, 75 to 80% of that is something that has already been funded, for which there's multiple massive numbers of publications. If we want to create innovation, fund the people who are not getting funding, who have innovation for which there may not be 55,000 publications, like the P53, which is undruggable, but there's thousands, tens of thousands of publications. We need a lottery system. If a person is qualified and they have a lab, don't make it based on peer-reviewed that are peer-reviewing the same publications. Just my comment. I said it to Senator Murphy, but I'll say it to you as well. I think there's a real deficit in what's innovative and being funded because of the way the system works.
Yeah, that is a really interesting idea. And before everybody dismisses it, think about Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, would not dismiss that, because he starts the book by talking about his work with another man to find leaders in the Israeli military by observing them on a particular exercise where five or six people had to get a huge tree trunk log over a wall and get on the other side of the wall without the trunk ever touching the ground. And they watched this exercise and they predicted who was the leader from the group, and they were always wrong. And they said, but that did not stop us from using the same process every time. And we were always wrong. So what does that tell you? Randomness can find winners. Lottery for some grants is not a bad idea at all. And second, we think we can predict success far greater than we can, but one thing we've also learned from behavioral science is if you tell someone they're a leader, they can become a leader. If you don't tell them that's the leader, but you're the leader, everything changes. So you have stated what I call the NIH conundrum, which is it's a lot of money. It touches every university, so when you try to change anything, you hear from every university because it's become the way we fund universities, not cures. NIH isn't the way we fund cures. It's the way we fund universities, and sometimes we get cures. If we want to design, and I've been on this hobby horse for over a decade with David Baltimore and Alan Leshner and Gail Cassell and a lot of people from the industry. If you want to change the outcome, you have to change the input. And the input at NIH is exactly what you said. Fund something you already know works, it's already been published, for someone you know, and then they'll spread it out with its trickle-down science. They'll spread it out to the 30-year-old lab person who's going to get a Nobel Prize for something they're working on at night because we couldn't fund them during the day. And that's pitiful. But there's one short way to fix it, which I've promoted and Biden's promoted now, is to change the on-campus programs at the NIH and the NCI, the intramural program, $3 billion. Instead of being another campus and basically a Division II campus, no offense to Division II, I'm from Arkansas, those campuses should be places where people do things they can't do anywhere else, where they do nanotechnology, where they do bizarre things in immunotherapy, where they do new things in imaging. That's what should be going on there, but it's not. What's going on there is the same science that we have at every university. That doesn't help. So we definitely have to change things from the inside out. Some of those changes, like the NCATS, National Consortium of Advanced Technology, that was a change, but it was only $1 billion. If you're a scientist and you're shooting for a grant, are you going to shoot at the $1 billion target or the $30 billion target? So we've got a long way to go there, but that's exactly where we have to start. So I think our time is up. I can't thank you all enough for your attention. Thank you very much.